Viradamo, other monastics, Anagarikas, lay friends. So you all probably know that the basic teachings of the Buddha are stated in the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, or as some translators are rendering it, stress or unsatisfactoriness, and the cause of suffering being ignorance and craving, that there can be a cessation to suffering, which is the overcoming and the elimination of ignorance and craving, and the way to live, think, and meditate, which will allow us to unravel the knot of ignorance and the comic web of greed, hatred, and delusion, to attain peace and freedom. And basically, you know, that the cause of suffering is basically, you know, within our mind. Although there may be many causes that we try to blame our suffering on, this and that, various things in the world, but the essential cause of suffering is right within our mind. And that my favorite sort of expression or little stanza of the Buddha is that the world, the arising of the world, the ceasing of the world, and the path leading to the ceasing of the world is right within this 5 or 6 foot long body with its nervous system, memory, and consciousness. And this statement actually arose from an interesting little story from the Buddha's time, from a sutta. And there was a deva, a certain deva, or celestial being, heavenly being, that could was very powerful, and with one stride he could cover 100 miles. And he wanted to find the end of the world. And so he was running and walking fast and running all over the universe, visiting different sages and asking them, where's the end of the world? Where's the end of the world? Even probably going all up to the highest Brahma realm to ask the so-called creator of the world, where's the end of the world? And he probably said, shh, don't tell anybody, but go ask the Buddha. So finally, after all of his traveling, he came back to ask the Buddha about, the end of the world. And that's when the Buddha told him. He said, dear Rohatisa, you're not going to find the end of the world by traveling physically. And that's when he said that the world, the arising of the world, the ceasing of the world, and the path leading to the ceasing of the world is right within this body and mind. And in the Dhammapada verses also, the first two Dhammapada verses, the Buddha said that all phenomena originate in the mind. Mind is their master. Mind is their maker. Act or speak with it. Impure mind, then suffering will follow. Act or speak with a pure state of mind, and happiness will follow. So this is the kind of attitude that we, undertake when we, especially when we are practicing meditation. And, the Buddha took, before the Buddha went and discovered his enlightenment, he was also visiting all the greatest sages of the time to learn the highest meditation techniques. And he went to, different teachers and were learning how to get his mind into infinite space and how to extend that to infinite consciousness, and even extending that to nothingness, and even extending that further to these mind-created states of produced through concentration. And when then he kept coming out of the meditation and he said, that was good, but, something's not right, He didn't think that that could be like the ultimate truth. He didn't think that that could be the end-all, be-all. And so he left those teachers and he said, look, why am I going around looking here, looking there, asking other people? And that's when he, you know, came to the Bodhi tree, sat down to the Bodhi tree, said, look, I'm not going to leave this seat till I discover the truth. And so he looked within himself. You know, why should he go and ask other people for the truth? He has a body and mind just as they did. He had intelligence. So he checked it out. And so he used his own body and mind as a scientific experiment. You know, he conducted the greatest experiment in the universe. You know, to discover the origin and the end of the world. And, you know, scientists these days or, you know, astrophysicists or whatever, that, you know, they're trying to figure out what was the source of the, you know, the universe. The Big Bang. You know, when did it start? Big Bang. And then they're trying to send out probes to the end of the universe. You know, to Pluto and beyond. The expanding universe. Wanting to find the end of the universe. Because scientists, you know, they're interested in these, you know, the origin and the end of these physical things, the physical earth or the solar system. But the Buddha wasn't really interested in that. Because even if you find out the origin of the earth or the end of the solar system, there's still suffering. And there's still this mind. And for the Buddha, that was what is the most important, is how to find, you know, the Big Bang of the mind. You know, when did the mind start? When did the mind of ignorance and greed, hatred, and delusion? That was what he was interested in finding the origin of. And also the end. So, for the Buddha, the world actually is the world of suffering, not the physical earth. And isn't that the most important thing for people? Nowadays, you all know, everybody's searching for stress reduction clinics. They're, you know, grabbing all kinds of pills and everything else to try to alleviate this kind of suffering, that kind of suffering, stress, trying every newest fad and pills or anything else, shock therapies, you know, trying to get some remedy. And even those things might have some palliative effects, in the long run, they probably don't work from a permanent point of view. So anyway, I wanted to explore this idea about, you know, conducting this, the great experiment, or the, you know, the greatest journey into the world. You know, the journey to the center of the mind. And, you know, in your meditation, you probably, you know, still have lots of thoughts. People get lost in thoughts. You know, that's one of the biggest hindrances after pain subsides and after you overcome sleepiness and so on. And the mind, you know, gets carried away in so many thoughts. You know, why do people get lost in thoughts? Because they don't see them coming. And, you know, thoughts originate in the very subtlest levels of the nervous system. You could say, I like to call, say, the cellular vibration of the nervous system, you know, where thoughts are originating. But because our mind is fixed in the outer world, we can't see them. We can't see the source of our thoughts. We only see it after we're lost into them. Oh my God, I've been thinking for 5 minutes. Because we didn't see them coming. So, you know, in order to, you know, to get at our thoughts, we have to use the body. The Buddha said, you know, the origin of the world is right within this body, mind, and nervous system. So that's the way that the Buddha, you know, in the Buddha's teaching of meditation, especially the outline of the Satipatthana Sutta, the great discourse, you know, at the beginning of that sutta, the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha said, this is the direct way for the overcoming of sorrow, lamentation, grief, pain, and despair, for arousing knowledge, for entering the right path, and for the reaching the end of suffering. And it was simply, you know, going through that, the four levels of the body and mind, contemplating the body, feelings, mental states, and subtler dhammas. So, you know, also one of the most frequent and common aspects of right understanding or wisdom, or even in the definition of suffering, you know, the Buddha defines suffering as the ordinary things, broken bones, aging, death, pain, despair around getting old and dying and losing things, basically pertaining to the material world. And then he said, not getting what you want and getting what you don't want is suffering. Now that's more sort of mental. And then in short, some people said, I can't remember all those things. And he said, okay, in short, the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. And so the five aggregates of clinging is a repeated theme whenever the Buddha is talking about the development of insight. And sometimes there's a lot of, you know, people see those as some sort of theory, like, you know, and body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. And you just treat them as some sort of a theory. But actually, you know, that's what is going on inside of us every single second of our life. And, you know, it's really the focus of insight meditation. You know, it's really the focus of developing wisdom. And it's the progressive development and the deepening of the scientific experiment. And so the five aggregates, the easiest way that I found to kind of relate to them is like five concentric circles. You know, you have one big circle, then maybe you put another one, you know, just inside that, an inch space perhaps, then another one inside that, and then another one inside that, and then the smaller one inside that. And basically those are the layers of our body and mind. So the physical body and the world around us, the physical world around us, and the physical body is that first, what's called the grasping group, or the first aggregate. They use the term aggregate or khanda. Sometimes it's difficult to... It basically means it's a collection of material forms, but basically it's this body and made up of the four elements, and also the things of the material world we're attached to, what we see, hear, smell, taste, and, you know, even think about, but especially the five physical senses. And they call them the aggregates of clinging because we cling to them. We identify with them as being I, me, and mine. And we cling to them as saying, I like these things, I don't like these things. And we've cultivated attachment to the things we think we like, we bring pleasurable feeling, and we have aversion and hatred toward the things that block our pleasurable feeling or threaten our pleasurable feeling. And the mind basically is caught in a tug of war between these conflicting realities that are occurring essentially, you know, every second coming through our senses. And so the mind gets stuck on those, and it's not able to go deeper. Like in your own meditation, when you're meditating, you know, maybe you start to try to focus on the breathing or something, and then you know you get some sharp pain in your knee, for example. Then you start worrying, oh, my knee, and so boom, your mind is stuck right there at the surface, hasn't even gone in yet. It's stuck on the surface of the knee, you know, stuck on the form. Or you hear a sound that's starting to bother you, and you know somebody's driving the tractor. You know, why doesn't that person stop driving the tractor? And you get stuck on the form. And so that because we're clinging to these various forms, so it's a very real thing, and we can directly observe that. But that stops us from allowing our mind to go deeper inside. Now this idea of meditation being like an scientific experiment. So you've all taken lab in college, chemistry lab, bio lab, I guess, right? So, you know, when you go into the lab to look through a microscope, usually the laboratory tables are firmly bolted or secured to the floor so they can't be pushed and shoved or moved. And the microscope is firmly secured to the table so it can't also be shaking or moving. So in that way, in this experiment, this body is like the laboratory. And at the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha says, okay, you know, meditators should go find a suitable place to meditate, sit down, you know, cross the legs, and, you know, keep the back straight. And why did he say keep the back straight? You know, the Buddha never wasted any words. Everything he said had some importance. Because meditation happens through the nervous system. That means learning how to cultivate mindfulness and concentration depends on the nervous system. So if you're sitting, you know, slouched over, then the mind is going to be half asleep, if not totally asleep, or at least, you know, not very clear. So by keeping the back straight, and also it's almost impossible to go to sleep keeping your back straight. And if your head is level with the ground, and you have that center of gravity, it's almost impossible to go to sleep. And the nervous system is in its most awake state because the nerves aren't pinched. Whenever you start to, the head goes down, start to slouch, then it's like putting the dimmer switch on. You know, the consciousness dims down. And by learning how to straighten up, you can almost feel a rush of current up to the brain, and the mind immediately gets more clear and awake. So that's the laboratory table is like this body and the posture, and to keep the body still also. Because if you're moving around, scratching this, rubbing this, turning to look at this, and getting distracted, then that's like somebody coming by and you're trying to look through the microscope and they keep bumping into the table and jiggling it, and it's difficult to see. And then the microscope is our mind. And so, you know, you're sitting down and you're feeling the posture, and then you sort of, you know, look through the microscope. That means you pick up on your breathing. You feel the breath. some certain spot or wherever you can kind of feel it to concentrate. And this comes to two important factors in meditation, two of the five spiritual faculties are mindfulness and concentration. Of course, the first two spiritual faculties are faith and energy. And if you don't have faith that something good will come out of learning to meditate, then you're not going to give it much effort. But the hope of learning something about your mind, the hope of being able to somehow control your thoughts and gain some inner peace or wisdom or enlightenment or whatever you might imagine, you know, that gives you the effort to to put forth to sit through pain and to get up in the morning to meditate or to practice other aspects of the Dhamma, but especially to continue meditating. Because many people start meditation, they give it up because they think it's too difficult or too painful. But anyway, the mindfulness and concentration are considered powers of the higher mind. And most people in the world are unmindful and unconcentrated. And because mindfulness means being alert and being aware of your intentions before your various thoughts and actions. But most people go around just automatically reacting to things like a robot without any clear consciousness as to why they're doing what they're doing, or just a very vague sense of it. And basically it's act impulsively. They don't know how to control their sort of actions. So they keep on repeating the same sort of unwholesome, neurotic actions that, produce stressful effects and so on. So anyway, balancing mindfulness and concentration are really the two things we need to deepen the meditation, or the things that we actually are trying to practice in meditation. And there's a big debate these days amongst various meditation teachers or schools of practice about whether you should practice concentration first or you should practice mindfulness first. And, and some people say, I just practice concentration. Others say, I just practice mindfulness. But the Buddha never meant it to be kind of polarized and compartmentalized in that way. In fact, it's very clear in the Buddha's teaching that actually mindfulness comes before concentration in almost every list or enumeration of steps. The Eightfold Path, and the Seven Factors of Enlightenment, and the Five Spiritual Faculties, in the five spiritual powers, mindfulness always precedes concentration. So people shouldn't be too hurried to develop concentration. They should learn how to be mindful first. And actually, concentration is simply unbroken mindfulness. It means the attention to an object that's not being disrupted by sleepiness, by wandering thoughts, by pains, or any other types of hindrances. So, in the practice of the meditation, the posture itself is that first object of mindfulness, to feel the body and to keep the body straight. So it takes mindfulness to do that, because the head's always going down. You have to check that, try to lift the head back up. The spine is starting to slouch. So you have to try to straighten up. Without the mindfulness, you won't be able to really focus your mind. But then anyway, you start focusing on the breathing. Or at least that's the preferred object of concentration in most of the Buddhist meditation schools. And the focus on the breathing is your concentration. So you try to, you know, keep the mind in one small little area to know that you're breathing in and knowing that you're breathing out by feeling whatever sensations you can notice. So that's, and any time the mind wanders, you come back. But you need the mindfulness in order to keep the mind concentrated. So without the mindfulness, you'll get distracted or lost in thoughts or fall asleep, and you know, you won't have any concentration. That's why mindfulness is actually the most important and needs to be cultivated even before concentrating. But actually, they should be, you can do them both at the same time. So you're focusing on the breathing, that's your concentration. But at the same time, you're alert for any thoughts coming in or other distractions. That's the mindfulness. So it's like you sort of divide your mind into two parts. Half of it is concentrating on the breath, but half of it is kind of in the background on standby. You know, monitoring. Oh, the head's starting to droop. Okay, straighten back up. Starting to slouch now. Okay, straighten back up. Starting to get lost in thought. Ah, thinking. Let go, come back. So like that, the mindfulness helps to strengthen one's concentration. So anyway, that's like, you know, coming back to the experiment. So you're looking into the, you have your body as the laboratory. You're looking through the microscope of the mind. And it's like you turn up the power of a microscope, right? When you're trying to examine something, let's say a blood sample. You put a blood drop on the glass. You look through. And then the outer, you know, you're no longer seeing the outside as a blood drop. Now you might see a cell inside, or a couple of cells. If you keep the focus from shaking. So it's like turning up the power of the microscope. And as you keep it there longer and longer, without being distracted, and again, it's the mindfulness that's preventing you from getting distracted in the hindrances. So they're continually working together, strengthening each other. The more mindful you are, the longer you won't get distracted and stay on your concentration subject. And the stronger the concentration becomes, it's like turning up the power of the microscope a little bit more. And so the clarity becomes more. So you see more details, subtler thoughts that are trying to steal your mind. You see subtler pains and sensations trying to distract you, or other things. And that, again, helps to strengthen, to keep the mind on target, on its focus of concentration. And so the first, the first level of meditation, what you could really call first stage of meditation, is that the stage of tranquility, where the mind is resting in the present moment, is, you know, come out of the external world and resting sort of in the middle of the breathing body, the present moment. Because the breathing body is really the home for our mind. That's where it started. When you were a one-cell organism in your mother's womb, there was already consciousness there. Consciousness of one cell. And then it divided. And every time it divided, that consciousness also went to all the other cells. Until now we have billions and billions of cells. But they all have consciousness. Well, for nine months, you know, the fetus was resting in the warm mother's womb. And all it had was body consciousness, basically, because it was tied into every cell. Only when it came out and the doctor hit it on its butt, you know, the Big Bang, right, into the world. And then the mind lost that cozy little unit of state of body awareness and started going out. You know, it saw a dog and got afraid or so many things. And then the mind gradually got lost its source, lost its original home. It lost its unit of state of awareness, which is basically, you know, just tied into every cell of the body. So the first stage really of meditation is when you balance, learn to balance both mindfulness and concentration. And so the mind can rest more and more, sort of, resting in the present moment. And the present moment is basically the breathing body. And it's like the nest. The breathing body is like the nest of a bird. The bird is like our mind. It's always flying out to get food. When it gets tired, it comes back to its nest. And so, whenever there's nothing else to do in the external world, you always have the breathing and body is there to feel the cells and the vibrations and the heartbeat and the breathing and so many other sensations, because that's its natural resting point, and it's tied in to every cell of the body. And so, that first sort of stage of learning how to get the mind rested in the present moment, and that's really when the exploration comes. And this is where the aspect of wisdom comes into play. Wisdom is actually the fifth of those spiritual faculties, especially the three mental powers of mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And wisdom is what's unique to the Buddha's teaching. Maybe not totally unique, but his emphasis was on cultivation of the wisdom. But the wisdom that's focused inside. And what are the objects of wisdom? What is the wisdom? It's the understanding of anicca, or impermanence. The understanding of how when you try to cling on to things that are impermanent, that's stressful, or it produces suffering because they change. And you want to hold on to them, but you can't. You can't hold on to them. They're changing, and so you suffer. And in this is also the Buddha was a very he was like the real scientist, you could say, one of the original scientists, developing scientific method. It's also explained in many suttas. And like the famous Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. He asked the monks, "What do you think, monks? Is form all these material objects? Are they impermanent or permanent?" And they said, "Impermanent, naturally." So they said, "Impermanent." So then he got them on that, right? Now they've said them impermanent. So he said, "What is impermanent? Is that a source of happiness or suffering?" And he said, "Suffering." Because you can't cling on to those things that are impermanent. You can't have them or last them. And then the real clincher, he said, "Well, what is impermanent and a source of suffering? Is it right to call that your own? Is it right to say, this is mine, this is myself, this am I?" The monk said, "No. And, you know, that's how we formulated the anatta. But it was by using the experience of, you know, impermanence. Because things are impermanent, they can't be depended on to bring happiness. And because of that, because you can't control anything, this body you can't control, the sounds, smells, tastes, any sense objects you can't control, anything of the, you can't control the weather, you can't control aging and death, really. So, you know, it can't be a, you can't really call that, this is mine, or myself. And this is what he focused on, these five concentric circles, or the five aggregates. You know, this body is not me, not mine, not myself. Feelings are not me, not mine, not myself. The perceptions, the mental formations, and even the subtler dhammas, or mental activities and so on. It's not me, not mine, not myself. Even consciousness is not one's own in the deepest level of understanding. So anyway, this is the wisdom, and this is the wisdom that arises, you know, out of the meditation. So anyway, once you've gotten the mind, you know, reached that first level of tranquility. It's called tranquility because the mind is wide awake, but it's not being disturbed anymore by any pains. There still might be pains going on, but it's like you've been injected with a tranquilizer. You know, and the nervous system is no longer reacting to various pains, and all sleepiness has gone out, and also the thoughts have been largely overcome. The mind is very tranquil. But this is an important part, because a lot of people get stuck in that tranquility. And because the pains are no longer distracting and the mind is aware, it becomes so peaceful that they can get sort of lost in that peace and kind of don't want to come out of it. Or the mind can kind of sink into a spaced out state. That's also a danger when the mind becomes too tranquil or too calm. It can kind of space out, like you'd smoked a good joint or something. But there's no mindfulness really with that. But it's a kind of a false meditation. A lot of people think they are meditating because you're not sleeping really. But it's almost like just in a kind of a dream state. But there's still some kind of awareness there. But it doesn't really go anywhere. And so the danger of getting trapped in that, it's what I call the trap of tranquility. Or some people might see a vision or a light or something, and oh, it's so nice, or some other blissful feelings, and kind of just woo-wee, kind of just want to hang out, you know. And if somebody comes by and disturbs them, they get angry or something. And so, but anyway, so this kind of meditation, even though it could have some kind of useful benefits, it's very limited. So the Buddha didn't want people to get stuck in this tranquility. But you use that to keep turning up the power of the microscope. And then you use the body itself. So the breathing is a device for getting into the body, for getting centered in the body, for developing that the concentration, you know, in the present moment. And also there's, you know, different kinds of concentration. The popular kind of concentration is a person thinks you fix your attention on an object, you get absorbed in that, and you forget about everything else. Everything else disappears and there's only the breathing. Now, you might be able to get into a state like that, but again, just staying with that alone and staying with that peacefulness may not go anywhere. But actually, when you gain concentration, the object then can be let go of, because the mind is resting in the present moment. Concentration means the mind is resting in the present moment without being distracted in any way. It doesn't have to have an object. The awareness itself is the object. But anyway, so then the body becomes the focus. So in the next step of the meditation instructions by the Buddha, after gaining that tranquility with the breathing, then this body itself, you know, in this body there is, you know, hair of the head, teeth, nails, skin. You sort of analyze that, see how it's impermanent. You see how it just came together because the mother and father had some fling, and you know, this little baby was created and consciousness went in, and then you have to feed and scrub this body, and it has to work and suffer the whole life, and then it gets a certain age and then dies. But what is it? So anyway, it's just it's a way of kind of detaching from this body and clinging to it, and knowing that all the things in the body are always changing and impermanent, and not to use this body to as the saying goes, what, win friends and influence neighbors and get a high paying job and win beauty contests or Mr. Universe contests and so on, because that brings a lot of suffering. So, but then even deeper, so you detach. See that this body is there. You're watching it sitting and breathing. This body is there, but we use it to gain mindfulness and awareness, not using it for a lot of other negative or bad actions, creating suffering. And then he has it dissected further to just the elements. So as you turn up the power of the microscope, you start feeling all these sensations. And you just feel the body as a mass of changing sensations. Because once you turn up the power of the microscope, that's what you're feeling. You're no longer looking outside at the outside of the body, you're feeling the inner body. And you're feeling all these sensations arising and vanishing. And this is the first level of impermanence. As you actually deliberately tune in to this impermanence. And you see the body as just the vibrations of solidity, fluidity, temperature, and movement. And the idea of my hand or my foot or my this or my that starts to disappear. And you train your mind on just being aware of vibrations. And especially tuning into how quickly they arise and vanish. And this is the perception of impermanence, actually, is really the entry toward the beginning of freeing the mind. And in some other verses in the suttas, the Buddha said the perception of impermanence, uproots and tears out all traces of ignorance and pride and conceit. And I'll kind of hopefully get to that in a moment. So you start cultivating the perception of impermanence. And because when you see the mind hold on to a certain pain, it gets stuck on that. Because it's clinging to the pain. So this is the level of also feelings. All these sensations that you're noticing, they're accompanied by either pain or pleasure. Some of them are painful, some of them are pleasurable. Many of them are neutral. But especially the painful ones, you try to notice as they grab your mind, and to try to relax around them, let go of them, and to notice something else. But the reason why our mind gets stuck on objects is because it's clinging. Oh, my knee, oh, my neck, oh, my this, my that. Oh, I got a pain in my kidney, oh, what's happening, I'm going to get sick. and the mind spins off on all these thoughts and worries because it's, again, it's clinging to these sensations, and then these sensations belong to the body, and this body belongs to me. See, this is the evolution of suffering. In reality, there's just sensations, and you're feeling these sensations, but then a certain sensation, you think, oh, that's a pain in the knee. So now the sensation, which was just floating around in inner space, somehow now belongs to a knee, is associated with a knee. And then this knee is on a body. And this body belongs to me. So there's four stages of the evolution in that. The raw experience is just, there's sensations. But because of perception, I'm going to get to that in a moment, we cling to the perception of knee or the body part, the sensation is connected with. And then that body part being in a larger body, this body belonging to me. And all that's created in the mind. So the training in impermanence, the training in the perception of impermanence is really the hallmark or the entryway for developing deeper wisdom and of that first level of understanding impermanence. But it's not limited to the body. Like when you're meditating, you feel the in-breath arise and vanish. So that's impermanent. The in-breath arises and vanishes. The out-breath arises and vanishes. Then some other sensation arises and vanishes. Another in-breath arises and vanishes. Then a body twitch arises and vanishes. Then a stomach gurgling arises and vanishes. And and you just begin to tune in to just the rising and vanishing moment to moment, but without allowing the mind to stick onto any particular sensation. But while you're doing that, then you see the perceptions. You can see how the mind creates mental images out of the vibrations. So the second aggregate is the feelings, the painful, pleasant, and neutral feelings connected with the forms. And then you perceive those material vibrations, you perceive them as being objects, my knee, my head, or even a sound. Your eyes are closed, you hear a sound, and you can see the mental images of, oh, that's a bird chirping, or a car going down the street, or thunder clapping, or the teacher talking, or somebody coughing. Those are perceptions, those little mental labels and names and images that popping into the mind based on what is just essentially vibrations, like hearing vibrations or other body vibrations. And you watch that. I mean, this is when it becomes interesting. This is the scientific experiment. You want to find out what is the body, how it arises, right? So now you're watching it. You've turned up the power of the microscope. And at the same time, you're continuing to develop concentration and mindfulness to deeper and deeper levels. And tuning into the moment-to-moment arising and vanishing of body sensations. You open it up to include sounds. And then even thoughts. You start to see thoughts popping up into the back of the mind. Before they've taken you away, you can kind of just see the thought of your mother, for example, trying to pop into your mind, but you kind of see that very clearly and it just vanishes. You don't cling to that or any other thought, a thought of anger or some other kind of thought. You kind of see it as just a bubble arising and you don't cling to it, it vanishes because there's always something else. See, there's always something else to notice. This is the great trick. This is what I call the trick of mindfulness. Is that we're tricking our mind out of itself. See, Mara has been ruling our mind. Ignorance has been ruling the mind. Ignorance of permanence, of you know, I, me, and mine, and all these concrete, real objects that we love and hate. And Mara is invested so much time and energy in protecting that illusion. And so, you know, it's a very deep illusion. That's why it takes somebody like the Buddha to figure this out. And so the perception of impermanence is sort of the key in dissolving perceptions and the created world. So you're turning in to just things arising and vanishing. Body sensations, sounds, thoughts, perhaps smell, taste, anything that comes within the range of the senses. You just notice it and let it go. Notice it and let it go. Because there's always something else to notice. So this is the difference between concentration and awareness or wisdom. In concentration, you think everything else is the enemy, and you try to block everything else out, and you only want that one object. But with the development of vipassana, it's the opposite. The more the better. Because there's no time for the mind to cling to any one thing, because there's always something else you can notice. If you feel a pain here, listen to something over here. You start to get attached to that and listen to something else. Don't allow the mind to get stuck, because there's always something you can notice, whether it's a body sensation, or it's a sound, or it's a thought. And just keep the mind kind of moving. And so there's no time for perceptions to arise. Because perception arises because we're clinging to that vibration, that material vibration, and creating a story out of it. And so it's similar to the child's coloring book. I like to use this example because it's really illustrative. You know, a child's coloring book. You have a page, it's full of dots. And if you just look at the dots, they don't mean much. But you give the child a green crayon and he connects these dots. Give him a red crayon, he creates those dots. Boom, Donald Duck. And so our mind basically is doing that. It's connecting the dots. Feels a few sensations here and there, and it says, oh, that's me sitting. Or it hears a few chirps of a bird, and it determines, oh, that's a whippoorwill, or that's an owl, or that's this or that. Or it sees in various colors, and it says, this is that object, because it's connecting all the dots. And the connecting of the dots is the cleaning of the mind to those dots. And then we get carried away. So the perception process also is very important, that it's connected to the feelings. And it's connected to the material vibrations. The perception is simply a mental image of the material vibration, which is just an empty energy vibration, basically. And then we react to that. Once you've determined what the object is, then because of memory and associations, you either have desire to hold on to that object or to push it away, or it triggers off your memory about these objects. It takes you to the past, keeps you projecting into the future. It triggers off so many different types of emotions, you know, jealousy, envy, fear, greed, pride, whatever. And, you know, we get lost in those. So those are what are called the mental formations. Or I like to call it the reactions, because it's the way we react. Like you have an itch. So there's a vibration there, and then you identify it. Oh, that's an itch on my body. And then I don't like it. And then the urge to want to scratch it. So that urge to want to scratch, and the scratching is a sankhara, is a habit formation, is a reaction. And every time you do that, it strengthens that reaction. And then it becomes a habit. But it's based on that evolution of material vibration, feeling, perception, and then the memory of your lifetime of experiences connected with that particular kind of vibration or object. And then there's a sense of I that I'm doing it. You know, the consciousness. And so each of those aggregates is subtler and subtler. The material form is the outside. If we're able to let go of that, we can observe feelings clearly. If we can let go of the feelings, then we can clearly see the perceptions arising and vanishing. And when the perceptions are arising and vanishing, there's no time for it to drag in the past or future. And we can see the urges and so on, but they also just arise and vanish. And then when we stop reacting to material vibration, feelings, perceptions, and our emotional states, other thoughts, other intentions, urges, it's all died down. And the mind also gains a deep level of tranquility. And there's just, you know, kind of an awareness there that's, a lot of things are happening, but that awareness is not creating any kind of stories out of it. But the sense of I is still there. You probably all experience that at one time or another in meditation. The mind gets quiet and tranquility, and there's a sense of I is still there in the mind. So that's the consciousness, or the ego consciousness, because for all ignorant people, that ego consciousness is functioning. And the ego actually is something created within the mind. And this is, again, the unique and unique to the Buddha's teaching, that this idea of the I or the self, we call the self in the Buddhist language, or you know, the kind of psychology, it refers to the sense of I, a separate I that's somehow inhabiting this body and mind, or sort of the one who's seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching, and thinking. And it's the I that actually, you know, separates, keeps the dualistic consciousness intact. And it's the I then that, you know, has desire and hatred, and the I that wants the pleasurable feeling, wants to get rid of the painful feeling. And so that I is, you know, the real deepest source of ignorance. But when the I exists in relationship to the object that it's identifying with, in direct proportion. So the amount of craving or aversion that's in the mind, that is what's creating the ego, the sense of I. Otherwise, consciousness in its pure state doesn't have a sense of I with it. It's been created through the ignorance. And so by not clinging on to any objects, by cultivating the perception of impermanence, just seeing things arising and vanishing without any clinging or aversion, without dragging in the past or future, the sense of I has nothing to stand on, and it kind of fades away because it's created only through the resistance to what it's resisting, wanting, or wanting to avoid. And it's similar to an ice cube. It's a nice little analogy. You know, ego is like an ice cube. So an ice cube is floating in the water, right? But the ice cube is also water, isn't it? But yet, it's separated from the water because it's frozen. And so it thinks it's something separate. And on a hot summer day when you're making a big punch or a Kool-Aid, right, for a party, you have all these ice cubes floating around, you know, knocking into each other, chink, 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 making music. So that's in the world. All these egos are bumping into each other, you know, fighting each other and causing lots of suffering. But what happens when that ice cube melts? So if there's one ice cube in the water and it melts, can you say my ice cube disappeared? Can you say the ice cube is still there? You can't say either of those. but there's no more resistance. And that is what happens in meditation. But it happens through, especially in the process of, let's say, following the development of vipassana meditation. That's how impermanence outfoxes the ego. By developing the perception of impermanence, there's nothing the ego can't stand on anything, because things are just arising and vanishing so fast it doesn't have any time to remember the past or future. And it's like the ice cube melting, and you experience freedom. You experience liberation. But it comes through that development, the perception of impermanence. And hence that that often repeated the phrase that in the suttas about, you know, the perception of impermanence when cultivated and grown great and deep uproots the conceit, I am. That's a very repeated, often repeated phrase by the Buddha, the conceit, I am. Basically, it means that that trace of I that's still there on the consciousness wanting to cling to itself or any of the objects that are, you know, coming into contact with that self. So, you know, and so that's the great experiment. You're training the mind to be aware of just material vibrations. And when you stop reacting to those, like turning up the power of the microscope, then you see feelings. You let go of those, you see perceptions, you let go of those, you see the urges and other mental formations, mental states, emotions without clinging to them. They're just arising and vanishing. And then you come down to just the last trace. Consciousness is the last stand, sort of the last frontier to let go of. But people still want to cling to that. And that's why the Buddha's teaching is about anatta, is that you train the awareness on even that sense of I until it also melts away. Or even though you don't even have to do that, by not clinging to the objects, the sense of self melts away. And that's why, you know, the whole kind of training in Satipatthana, in these four foundations of mindfulness, four stages of mindfulness, body, feelings, mental states, and then the subtle dhammas, which means the five aggregates, contemplating the six senses and seeing no self in those. And that's where you dissolve the mind. So you come to the origin of the mind, or you come to the end of the mind, sort of the end of the conditioned mind. And you also understand how that mind arises because of the ignorance and so on. The sense of I continues to arise, but with the application of wisdom, with the cultivation of mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, then that origin can, you know, vanish, can cease. And that is the path leading to the end of suffering. Of course, the internal path, and then there's the external eightfold path of living in the world and practicing sila and right livelihood and so many of the other aspects of training ourselves. So, anyway, that's what I kind of just wanted to share with you, and maybe that's enough. Maybe enough.
Andamayam dhamma kata sadhu karang tatamase sadhu 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 anamodhami.
Thank you, Venerable. Please come often.
I encourage you to keep